Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents He, Understanding Masculine Psychology, by Robert A. Johnson, narrated by Walter Dixon. Introduction. Often, when a new era begins in history, a myth for that era springs up simultaneously. The myth is a preview of what is to come, and it contains sage advice for coping with the psychological elements of the time. In the myth of Parsifal's search for the Holy Grail, we have such a prescription for our modern day. The Grail myth arose in the 12th century, a time when many people feel that our modern age began. Ideas, attitudes, and concepts we are living with today had their beginnings in the days when the Grail myth took form. One can say that the winds of the 12th century have become the whirlwinds of the 20th century. The theme of the Grail myth was much in evidence in the 12th, 13th, and 14th centuries. We will be using the French version, which is the earliest written account, taken from a poem by Chrétien de Troyes. There is also a German version by Wolfram von Eschenbach. The English version, La Mort d'Arthur by Thomas Malory, comes from the 14th century, but by that time it had been elaborated a great deal. The French version is simpler, more direct, and nearer to the unconscious. Therefore, it is more helpful for our purposes. We must remember that a myth is a living entity and exists within every person. You will get the true living form of the myth if you can see it as it spins away inside yourself. The most rewarding mythological experience you can have is to see how it lives in your own psychological structure. The Grail myth speaks of masculine psychology. That is not to say that it is confined to the male, for a woman participates in her own inner masculinity, though it is less dominant for her. We must take everything that goes into the myth as part of ourselves. We will have to cope with a dazzling array of fair damsels, but must see them, too, as parts of the masculine psyche. Women, too, will be interested in the secrets of the Grail myth, for every woman has to cope with one of these exotic creatures, the male of the species, somehow, as father, or husband, or son. Also, a woman partakes quite directly of the Grail myth as the story of her own interior masculinity. Especially as modern women take more part in the masculine world by embracing a profession, the development of masculinity becomes important to her. A woman's masculinity or a man's femininity is closer than one realizes. The insights of this myth will be immediate and practical for our present time. The Fisher King. Our story begins with the Grail Castle, which is in serious trouble. The Fisher King, the king of the castle, has been wounded. His wounds are so severe that he cannot live, yet he is incapable of dying. He groans, he cries out, he suffers constantly. The whole land is in desolation, for a land mirrors the condition of its king, inwardly in a mythological dimension, as well as outwardly in the physical world. The cattle do not reproduce. The crops won't grow. Knights are killed. Children are orphaned. Maidens weep. There is mourning everywhere, all because the Fisher King is wounded. The notion that the welfare of a kingdom depends upon the virility or power of its ruler has been a common one, especially among primitive people. There are still kingdoms in the primitive parts of the world where the king is killed when he can no longer produce any offspring. He is simply killed, ceremonially, sometimes slowly, sometimes horribly, because it is thought that the kingdom will not prosper if the king is becoming weak. The whole Grail Castle is in serious trouble because the Fisher King is wounded. The myth tells us that years before, early in his adolescence, when he was out wandering around in the woods doing his knight errantry, the Fisher King came to a camp. All the people of the camp were gone, but there was a salmon roasting on a spit. He was hungry. There was the salmon roasting over the fire, and he took a bit of it to eat. He found that the salmon was very hot. After burning his fingers on it, he dropped the salmon and put his fingers into his mouth to assuage the burn. In so doing, he got a bit of the salmon into his mouth. This is the Fisher King wound, and gives its name to the ruler of much of our modern psychology. Modern suffering man is the heir to this psychological event, which took place culturally some 800 years ago. Another version of the story has it that the young Fisher King was overwhelmed with amour one day and was out hunting for some experience of his passion. Another night, a Muslim pagan had a vision of the true cross and was out searching for some expression of this quest. The two came within sight of each other and, like true knights, each lowered visor and lance and went at the other. There was a terrible clash. The pagan knight was killed, and the Fisher King received the wound in his thigh, which blighted the kingdom for so many years. What a sight! The knight of vision and the knight of sensuousness clash in terrible combat. Instinct and nature now suddenly having been touched by a vision of spirit clashing with pure spirit, which has been touched by a vision of instinct and nature. Such is the crucible within which the highest evolution can take place, or a deadly conflict capable of psychological destruction. I shudder at the implications of this clash, for it leaves us the legacy of our sensuous nature killed and our Christian vision terribly wounded. Hardly a modern man escapes this collision in his own life, and he may end up in the sad state described in our story. His passion is killed, and his vision is badly wounded. The story of Saint George and the Dragon, which was adapted from a Persian myth at the time of the Crusades, says much the same. In battle with the dragon, Saint George, his horse, and the dragon were all mortally wounded. They would all have expired, but for the fortuitous event that a bird pecked at an orange, or a lime, that was hanging on a tree over St. George, and a drop of the life-giving juice fell into his mouth. St. George arose, squeezed some of the elixir into his horse's mouth, and revived him. No one revived the dragon. Much is to be learned from the symbol of the wounded Fisher King. The salmon, or more generally, the fish, is one of the many symbols of Christ. As in the story of the Fisher King coming upon the roasting salmon, a boy in his early adolescence touches something of the Christ nature within himself, but touches it too soon. He is unexpectedly wounded by it, and drops it immediately as being too hot. But a bit of it gets into his mouth, and he can never forget the experience. His first contact with what will be redemption for him later in his life is a wounding. This is what turns him into a wounded Fisher King. The first touch of consciousness in a youth appears as a wound or as suffering. Parsifal finds his Garden of Eden experience by way of the bit of salmon. That suffering stays with him until his redemption or enlightenment many years later. Most Western men are Fisher Kings. Every boy has naively blundered into something that is too big for him. He proceeds halfway through his masculine development and then drops it as being too hot. Often a certain bitterness arises, because, like the Fisher King, he can neither live with the new consciousness he has touched, nor can he entirely drop it. Every adolescent receives his Fisher King wound. He would never proceed into consciousness if it were not so. The Church speaks of this wounding as the felix culpa, the happy fall, which ushers one into the process of redemption. This is the fall from the Garden of Eden, the graduation from naive consciousness into self-consciousness. It is painful to watch a young man realize that the world is not just a toy and happiness, to watch the disintegration of his childlike beauty, faith, and optimism. It is regrettable, but necessary. If we are not cast out of the Garden of Eden, there can be no heavenly Jerusalem. In the Catholic liturgy for Holy Saturday evening, there is a beautiful line. O happy fall that was the occasion for so sublime a redemption! The Fisher King wound may coincide with a specific event, an injustice, such as being accused of something we didn't do. In Dr. Jung's autobiography, he tells us that once his professor read all of Jung's classmates' papers in the order of their merit, but didn't read Jung's paper at all. His professor then said, "There is one paper here that is by far the best, but it is obviously a forgery. If I could find the book, I would have him expelled." Jung had worked hard on the paper, and it was his own creation. He never trusted that man or the whole schooling process after that. This was a Fisher King wound for Dr. Jung. Stages of Evolution. According to tradition, there are potentially three stages of psychological development for a man. The archetypal pattern is that one goes from the unconscious perfection of childhood to the conscious imperfection of middle life to conscious perfection of old age. One moves from an innocent wholeness, in which the inner world and the outer world are united, to a separation and differentiation between the inner and outer worlds, with an accompanying sense of life's duality, and then, at last, to enlightenment, a conscious reconciliation of the inner and outer in harmonious wholeness. We are witnessing the Fisher King's development from stage one to stage two. One has no right to talk about the last stage until he has accomplished the second one. One has no right to talk about the oneness of the universe until he is aware of its separateness and duality. We can do all manner of mental acrobatics and talk of the unity of the world, but we have no chance of functioning truly in this manner until we have succeeded in differentiating the inner and outer worlds. We have to leave the Garden of Eden before we can start the journey to the heavenly Jerusalem. It is ironic that the two are the same place, but the journey must be made. A man's first step out of the Garden of Eden into the world of duality is his Fisher King wound, the experience of alienation and suffering that ushers him into the beginning of consciousness. The myth tells us that the Fisher King wound is in the thigh. You may remember the biblical story about Jacob wrestling with the angel. He was wounded in the thigh. A touch of anything transpersonal, an angel, or Christ in the guise of a fish, leaves the terrible wound that cries incessantly for redemption. The wound in the thigh means that the man is wounded in his generative ability, in his capacity for relationship. One version of the story has it that the Fisher King was wounded by an arrow that transfixed both testicles. The arrow could not be pushed through, nor could it be withdrawn. Again, the Fisher King is described as being too ill to live, but unable to die. Much of modern literature revolves around the lostness and alienation of the hero. Moreover, we can see this alienation in the countenance of almost everyone we pass on the street. The Fisher King wound is the hallmark of modern man. I doubt if there is a woman in the world who has not had to mutely stand by as she watched a man agonize over his Fisher King aspect. She may be the one who notices, even before the man himself is aware of it, that there is suffering and a haunting sense of injury and incompleteness in him. A man's suffering in this way is often driven to do idiotic things to cure the wound and ease the desperation he feels. Usually he seeks an unconscious solution, outside of himself, complaining about his work, his marriage, or his place in the world. The Fisher King is carried about in his litter, groaning, crying in his suffering. There is no respite for him, except when he is fishing. This is to say that the wound, which represents consciousness, is bearable only when the wounded is doing his inner work, proceeding with the task of consciousness which was inadvertently started with the wound in his youth. This close association with fishing will soon play a large part in our story. The Fisher King presides over his court in the Grail Castle, where the Holy Grail, the chalice from the Last Supper, is kept. Mythology teaches us that the king who rules over our innermost court sets the tone and character for that court, and thus our whole life. If the king is well, we are well. If things are right inside, they will go well outside. With the wounded Fisher King presiding at the inner court of modern Western man, we can expect much outward suffering and alienation. And so it is. The kingdom is not flourishing. The crops are poor, maidens are bereaved, children are orphaned. This eloquent language expresses how a wounded archetypal underpinning manifests itself in problems in our external lives. The Inner Fool. Every night, there is a solemn ceremony in the Grail Castle. The Fisher King is lying on his litter, enduring his suffering, while a procession of profound beauty takes place. A fair maiden brings in the lance which pierced the side of Christ at the crucifixion. Another maiden brings the paten which held the bread at the Last Supper. Another maiden brings the grail itself, which glows with light from its own depth. Each person is given wine from the grail and realizes their deepest wish even before they voice that wish. Each person, that is, except the wounded Fisher King, who may not drink from the grail. This is surely the worst deprivation of all, to be barred from the essence of beauty and holiness when just those qualities are right in front of you is the cruelest of all suffering. All are served except the Grail King. All are conscious that their very center is deprived because their king cannot partake of the Grail. I remember a time when beauty was denied me in just this manner. Many years ago, I was particularly lonely and at odds with the world during a trip to visit my parents for Christmas. My journey took me through San Francisco, and I stopped at my beloved Grace Cathedral. A performance of Handel's Messiah was scheduled for that evening, so I stayed to hear this inspiring work. Nowhere is it better done than in that great building, with its fine organ and master choristers. A few minutes into the performance, I was so unhappy that I had to leave. It was then that I knew that the pursuit of beauty or happiness was in vain, since I could not partake of the beauty, even though it was immediately at hand. No worse or frightening pain is possible for us than to realize that our capacity for love or beauty or happiness is limited. No further outward effort is possible if our inward capacity is wounded. This is the Fisher King wound. How many times have women said to their men, "Look at all the good things you have. You have the best job you have ever had in your life. Our income is better than ever. We have 2 cars. We have 2 and sometimes 3-day weekends. Why aren't you happy? The grail is at hand. Why aren't you happy?" The man is too inarticulate to reply, "Because I am a Fisher King and am wounded and cannot touch any of this happiness." A true myth teaches us the cure for the dilemma which it portrays. The grail myth makes a profound statement of the nature of our present-day ailment and then prescribes its cure in very strange terms. The court fool, and every good court has its resident fool, had prophesied long ago that the Fisher King would be healed when a holy, innocent fool arrived in the court and asked a specific question. It is a shock to us that a fool should have to answer to our most painful wound, but this solution is well known to tradition. Many legends put our cure in the hands of a fool or someone most unlikely to carry healing power. The myth is telling us that it is the naive part of a man that will heal him and cure his Fisher King wound. It suggests that if a man is to be cured, he must find something in himself about the same age and about the same mentality as when he was wounded. It also tells us why the Fisher King cannot heal himself, and why, when he goes fishing, his pain is eased, though not cured. For a man to be truly healed, he must allow something entirely different from himself to enter into his consciousness and change him. He cannot be healed if he remains in the old Fisher King mentality. This is why the young fool part of himself must enter his life if he is to be cured. In my consulting room, a man barks at me when I prescribe something strange or difficult for him. "What do you think I am, a fool?" And I say, "Well, it would help." This is humbling medicine to accept. A man must consent to look to a foolish, innocent, adolescent part of himself for his cure. The inner fool is the only one who can touch his Fisher King wound. Parsifal. The story now turns from the Fisher King and his wound to the story of a boy who is of so little consequence that he has no name. He is born in Wales, during that time a country geographically on the fringe of the known world and a cultural backwater, the least likely place for a hero to appear, and reminds one of another hero who was born in an unlikely place. What good could come out of Nazareth? Who would ever think of Wales as possibly producing an answer to our suffering? Myth informs us that our redemption will come from the least likely place. This reminds us again that it will be a humbling experience to find our redemption from the highly sophisticated wound of the Fisher King. The origin of the word humble traces back to humus, It means of the earth, feminine, unsophisticated. This reminds us of the biblical injunction, "Except ye become as a little child, ye cannot enter the kingdom of heaven." In his Typology of the Personality, Dr. Jung observes that every educated person has one superior function of the four functions of feeling, thinking, sensing, and intuiting, which make up the human temperament. Also, as a part of our psychology, there is an opposing inferior function. While our superior function produces most of the high value of our life, the more developed personality strengths, it also leads us into our Fisher King wound. Our inferior function, that part of us which is least differentiated, will heal us from that wound. So it is the innocent fool from Wales who will heal the Fisher King. The boy is of such lowly origin that he has no name when we first meet him. Later we will learn that his name is Parsifal, innocent fool. The name also has a deeper meaning, he who draws the opposites together and foretells his healing role, something like the meaning of the Chinese word Tao. Dr. Jung describes an occasion when he was forced to rely on just this faculty in himself. The falling out between Jung and Freud occurred over the nature of the unconscious. Freud said that the unconscious is the repository of all the inferior elements of the personality, the unvalued things of one's life. Jung insisted that the unconscious is also the matrix, the artesian well from which all creativity springs. Freud would have none of this, so the two parted. That was a frightening experience for Dr. Jung, since he was young and untried, with no reputation of his own. It looked as if he were finishing an abortive career before it began. Dr. Jung knew where to look for the cure of his desperate wound and looked to his inner world. He locked himself in his room and waited on the unconscious. Soon he was down on the floor playing childish games. This led to the recall of his childhood fantasies, which soon filled his attention. For months, he labored daily in the privacy of his fantasy, and in his backyard, he built stone villages, towns, and forts. He had fantasized all of this as a boy. He trusted his childlike experience, and that was the beginning of an outpouring from the collective unconscious from which we have the legacy of Jungian psychology. A great man was humble, earthy, enough to trust his Parsifal for his cure. Parsifal, we will call him that, though he does not have a name until much later in the story, is raised by his mother, whose name is Heart's Sorrow. His father is dead, and he knows nothing of him. He has no brothers or sisters. The redeeming hero in mythology often has no father and is raised in humble and lonely circumstances. Parsifal grows up in primitive, peasant way, wears homespun clothes, has no schooling, asks no questions, and is completely untutored. Early in his adolescence, he is out playing one day when five knights came riding by, wearing all their impressive equipment. The scarlet and gold trappings, the armor, the shields, the lances, all the accoutrements of the knighthood. They dazzled poor Parsifal so completely that he dashed home to tell his mother he had seen five gods. He was on fire with this marvelous sight, and decided to leave immediately to join the five wonderful men. His mother burst into tears after seeing there was no way to stop her son from following in the footsteps of his father, who had been a knight and who was killed in some foolishness. His mother had tried to shield Parsifal from knowing anything of his lineage, but no mother has ever succeeded in keeping her son from danger when his father's blood begins to stir in him. Heart's Sorrow, for this is the character of the moment as viewed by any mother, then tells Parsifal that his father had been a knight and been killed rescuing a fair maiden. His two brothers were also knights and had also been killed. Heart's Sorrow had taken Parsifal to a remote place to raise him in hope he could be shielded from a similar fate. Heart's Sorrow gives Parsifal her blessing and releases him from her protection. She cannot resist giving him advice as he leaves, to respect fair damsels and instruction not to ask too many questions. Also, he receives the gift of a single homespun garment she has woven for him. These are the legacies she bestows upon him. These two gifts will reverberate throughout the whole story and be instrumental in many of the complexities of what follows. Parsifal's Journey. Parsifal goes off happily to find his five knights and begin his career as a man. Parsifal asks everyone he meets, "Where are the five knights?" The look in an adolescent's eyes when he searches for his five knights is the question, "Where is it?" The "it" always being only vaguely defined. A youth has had his first glimpse of meaning and value in the form of the fiveness of life, and he searches throughout most of his adult life for experiences that will embody this quality. The number five implies the completion of life, and is the root from which we form our word, quintessence, the fifth essence. Five implies completion. The five is everywhere, but elusively also nowhere. It seems cruel to flash a vision of completion to a 16-year-old boy and send him out on the road to find embodiment of that quality. But such is the motivation of any true spiritual life. In his searching, Parsifal comes to a tent. He never had seen a tent before, for he had grown up in a simple hut. The tent is the most magnificent place he has ever seen, so he presumes he has come to the divine cathedral of his mother's stories. He bursts into the tent to worship and finds a fair damsel. This is the first of a glittering, dazzling, incomprehensible array of fair damsels whom Parsifal will meet. Parsifal remembers his mother's instructions to treat women fairly. He also remembers not to ask too many questions. He proceeds to cherish the fair maiden by embracing her and taking the ring from her finger as a talisman from her. This will be his inspiration for the rest of his life. Have you ever seen a boy on his first date? He is always Parsifal, blundering into the fair damsel's tent for the first time. Parsifal had been told by his mother that he would have all the nourishment, all the food that he would need for his life in God's church, and it is all there before him in the form of a table set for a banquet. The damsel is waiting for her beloved knight, who is courting her, and she has spread out her best for him. But to Parsifal, this is prophecy working out perfectly. Here is God's temple, here is the fair damsel, here is everything he could wish to eat. Everything is just as his mother said it would be. Parsifal sits down to eat at the table and find that life is good. The damsel by this time is becoming aware that she is in the presence of an extraordinary person. She is not angry, for she sees that before her is a truly holy, simple, guileless person. She implores Parsifal to leave immediately, because if her knight comes and finds him in the tent, Parsifal will be killed. Parsifal obeys the maiden and leaves her tent. He finds that life is good, just as his mother had taught him. The Red Knight. Parsifal asks everyone he finds how he may become a knight. He is informed that he should go to Arthur's court, where he will be knighted by the king, if he is strong and brave enough. He finds his way to Arthur's court, where he is laughed out of the great hall for his naivete, the look of his homespun garment, and his rashness at asking to be knighted. He is told that knighthood is an arduous life, and that to be made a knight is an honor won only after much valor and noble work. Parsifal asks again and again, until finally he is brought before King Arthur himself. Arthur, a kindly man, doesn't scorn Parsifal, but tells him he must learn a great deal and be versed in all the knightly arts of battle and courtliness before he can be knighted. Now, there is in Arthur's court a damsel who has not smiled or laughed for 6 years. The legend in the court is that when the best knight in the world appears, the damsel who has not smiled for 6 years will burst into laughter. The instant this damsel sees Parsifal, she bursts into laughter and joy. The court is mightily impressed with this. Apparently, the best knight in the world has appeared. Here is this naive youth, this boy in a homespun garment, completely untutored, and the maiden is laughing. Extraordinary. Until the Parsifal part of a man's nature appears, there is a feminine part of him that has never smiled, that is incapable of happiness, and she bursts into laughter and joy at the sight of Parsifal. If one can awaken the Parsifal in a
sample complete. Ready to continue?